Iowa was first in the nation to offer telemed abortions. The Iowa Board of Medicine later banned them, and a Polk County district judge has now ruled that it was within its authority when it did so. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Stanton, in for Ben Kiefer. We hear from IPR's Joyce Russell about what might be in store for telemedicine, who is celebrating the decision, and who thinks it's a bad idea. And it's Friday. That means a News Buzz edition of our show. So we also talk about Iowa's Environmental Protection Commission's decision to adopt new rules for confined animal feeding operations that have roofs. Later in the show, detaining inmates to check immigration status, an Iowa Ironman triathlete, we remember historian Dorothy Schweder, and beer caves. Join us for News Buzz after this news. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Stanton, in for Ben Kiefer. A judge has declared the Iowa Board of Medicine did follow its correct authority when it made the decision to ban the delivery of abortion-inducing drugs through video conferencing, sometimes called telemed abortions. That in just a minute. This is a News Buzz edition of the program, so we also have many other topics to get to. Coming up, the Environmental Protection Agency has been pressuring states to adopt new rules for manure disposal, and Iowa has indeed made changes to confined animal feeding operations. We'll talk with a regional representative of the EPA. We also remember Iowa historian and teacher Dorothy Schweder, who died last week. We'll talk with the colleague and friend of hers about her unique approach to history and teaching history. To end our show, Ironman T.J. Tollickson will talk about his win of the North American Ironman Championship. He swam 2.4 miles, then rode a bike 112 miles, then ran a marathon all in one day, one after the other. That was last weekend, to win the North American Ironman Championship in Quebec. We'll talk with him later. But first, telemed abortions. And joining us to talk about telemed abortions, Joyce Russell, Iowa Public Radio reporter. Joyce, thanks for being on the show.
Sure.
Well, Iowa was first in the nation to offer telemed abortions, a measure that delivered that service to rural populations who are far away from reproductive health care. But Joyce, let's have a bit of a review. Can you remind us, what exactly is this method of drug delivery called telemed abortion?
It is, in effect, the dispensing of so-called medical abortions, which are performed with a two-dose a medical application. And telemed abortion simply means that a doctor is talking to the patient out in, for example, a rural clinic, but it's not in person. And then the medicine is distributed to the patient, and then under the care of other health professionals at that remote clinic, the abortion is performed.
And so that began in a few years back, 2008, I believe.
I just called up a map that I had when I did some reporting on this, and this is 2010. So I think the 2010 was when this really got going. And the map shows just how far the reach became for women seeking abortions with this new method. The map, you know, is Red Oak, Creston, Knoxville, Spencer. So you get the idea of the size of towns that had and continue to have availability of abortion services as a result of this.
I continue to have, but not for much longer.
Well, it depends on how this lawsuit eventually plays out. The Planned Parenthood went to court to ask for a stay of the Board of Medicine rule banning this procedure. That stay was granted by District Court Judge Karen Romano last year. And then because of the way that district court judges are assigned to cases, they're rotated from time to time. And Karen Romano was rotated out of civil court and into criminal court. And so the case landed in Jeffrey Farrell's courtroom. He is the one who ruled that the temporary stay should end in 30 days. In other words, they ruled in favor of the Board of Medicine, and so unless something else happens in the courts, then that stay will end, and the procedure will be banned. But Planned Parenthood has challenged that, and the next step, they're hoping, will be an extension of Judge Romano's stay.
That's right. So Polk County District Judge Jeffrey Farrell, as you mentioned, made that decision earlier. But he also had some criticism about the board's process. What did he say?
Well, yeah, he said that they were within their rights, that they followed state law in issuing their ruling that these telemed abortions would no longer be allowed. However, he did, as you say, point out, really he pointed right to one of the controversies with their ruling is that it happened very quickly. Certain people were not, because it happened quickly, certain people were not really allowed input on it. And so he waited. Obviously, the judge waited, but said they were still within their rights what they did.
And remind us, who makes up the Iowa Board of Medicine? What types of people are on that board?
There are lay people. There are doctors. It's like any other board. The significant thing in this case is that this board was all appointed by Governor Branstad, approved by the Iowa Senate, but the board was revamped after earlier studying the issue and concluding that it was safe. So that's what's made it that telemed abortions were safe. So that's what's made it so controversial is that the Board of Medicine weighed in on this, cleared telemed abortions, said they were safe, and Governor Branstad sort of cleaned house on that board, and then the new board shifted gears.
And when the board, we talked about the board making a decision, of course, as many people voting, are these votes unanimous?
I believe it was a unanimous ruling. I'm not recalling that for sure, but I believe it was a unanimous ruling.
So,
unanimous vote.
Right. So tell us, what other drugs are administered this way when we talk about the video conferencing and delivering of these abortion-inducing drugs? Is it unique to abortion?
No, it's a growing trend, especially in rural Iowa. It's a very effective way to dispense medical care without having the doctor present in the room. Most recently, the Board of Corrections has been looking into psychiatric care for inmates via telemedicine. Well, I should say two-way audiovisual communication.
Right. Well, tell us, you've kind of hinted at what's coming up here. We're in this 30-day period here, and what's happening next?
Well, the Planned Parenthood says they will appeal Judge Farrell's ruling, and the first thing I'm sure they'll be looking to do is to get the stay extended while they challenge this in a higher court, probably the Iowa Supreme Court.
Okay. Well, we'll look forward to more of your reporting. Thank you so much for your reporting and for joining us today. Joyce Russell, Iowa Public Radio reporter.
Okay. Thank you.
This is a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. We have a lot of news to get through in this course of this hour. And coming up next, Iowans that run confined animal feeding operations, sometimes called CAFOs, will need to follow new rules enacted by the Iowa's Environmental Protection Commissioner's decision to make some new rule changes for operations that have roofs. The Iowa legislature asked that the commission make the new rules, and it comes after the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency has been encouraging states to do so. And this change is also a condition of a work plan agreement between the Iowa Department of Natural Resources and the EPA that was signed almost a year ago. The rules require facilities to have a federal permit to discharge in waterways and must get a National Pollutant Discharge Elimination System permit. And they also need to meet federal design, construction, and monitoring standards. Well, joining us to talk through the rules and what's happening in surrounding states, Karen Florney is Water Division Director at Region 7 of the EPA, and she joins us now. Thank you for being here.
Thanks a lot. I appreciate the opportunity.
I'm glad to have you on, and we should say Region 7 of the EPA covers what states?
Kansas, Missouri, Iowa, and Nebraska.
What has the EPA been asking states to do?
Well, for many years, there have been rules for concentrated animal feeding operations. And in the early 2000s, the EPA issued some updated rules, which then we got sued on. We had to modify the rules. Then we had another lawsuit. So we've been through quite a process to get the final updated regulations in place. So Iowa, like many other states around the country, are in the process of updating their regulations to match the federal regulations.
And so when we talk about the work plan that was an agreement between the Iowa DNR and the EPA, what exactly was that?
Okay, the work plan agreement resulted from a petition that the agency received in 2007. Three organizations, the Iowa Citizens for Community Improvement, the Environmental Integrity Project, and the Sierra Club, petitioned EPA alleging that the Iowa Department of Natural Resources CAFO permitting program did not meet the requirements of the Clean Water Act. So if the program truly did not meet those requirements, then their authorization to run that program would fall back to EPA if the petition was granted. What EPA did was conducted an evaluation of the IDNR program. We issued a report in July of 2012, and of the 31 allegations contained in the petition, all but five had been addressed by IDNR. So the work plan that was signed by IDNR, Chuck Gipp, and our director, Carl Brooks, in September of 2013, really focused on those remaining items that our evaluation found that IDNR could improve their program, and that focused on some of the areas identified in the petition.
And one of those five was too much manure going into waterways, I guess?
Well, one of the five was to update their regulations, which was the action that the Environmental Protection Commission took on August 19th.
Tell us what exactly Iowa has done now. What are the new rules in place?
Well, these rules focus on confinements, operations where the animals are under roof. And it was the last piece of updated regulations that IDNR needed to put in place. They had already put in place the updated regulations for open feedlots. This would focus and be applicable only to a confinement facility, that would discharge to water. So if a confinement is not discharging to water, then they do not need a permit.
And do we know how many do discharge and how many don't?
No, that's part of what IDNR is determining under the work plan, is evaluating the facilities to determine whether or not they would need a permit.
And those that don't discharge to water, I imagine using manure as fertilizer?
Yes. Many facilities, both open lots and confinements, do use manure as fertilizer.
So do these rules look the way that you expected them to look in Iowa?
Yes, they do. They adopted or passed the rules that are exactly like the federal rules. And we had worked with IDNR beforehand. We knew that's what they were going to do. So those rules then obviously meet our requirements.
They meet your requirements, but were you hoping do they do enough? I mean, in your eyes, they meet a standard, but as far as how can you characterize that?
Well, they met what the Clean Water Act requires, the same rules that we would implement or that we do implement if we are taking an action at a facility or evaluating a facility. States certainly have the opportunity to implement more stringent regulations, but they have met what the Clean Water Act requires. In order to maintain operation of the program and be the organization that issues the permits, they need to meet those minimum requirements. They can't have less. They can have more, but we cannot require them to have anything more stringent than the Clean Water Act.
Right. Well, characterize the rest of Region 7. Your region includes Kansas, where you are, Nebraska, Missouri, and, of course, Iowa. So what's happening in those other states?
Well, in all of the states, each state's animal feeding operation program is a little bit different. So it's not really easy to compare and contrast. But all the state programs, the states issue permits, they have regulations that meet the federal regulations, and they, you know, do inspections and enforcement. So from that standpoint, all of the programs are similar. There may be additional aspects of a state program that any of them have put in place that could be a little bit different, so I can't speak to those.
But can you speak to Iowa's water quality itself as compared to those states?
Well, from an overall water quality perspective, what I would tell you is in the last 30 to 40 years across the country, water quality has improved significantly. There's still certainly more work to be done in every state, but we have much cleaner waters now than we did in the past. So each state assesses their waters. They evaluate them to see what levels of pollutants are in the water. They compare those levels of pollutants to their state criteria. The criteria is based on whether that water is used for swimming, irrigation, recreation, whatever the use may be. And then they evaluate that information about the water against those criteria and determine whether or not additional work needs to be done in the watershed to improve the water quality of that water body. So every state does that on an ongoing basis. And Iowa, like all of the states, do that. Their list could have more or less waters than another state, but it doesn't necessarily mean that their water quality is any better or any worse, simply because it is very much an ongoing process. What I would say is Iowa, as you all know, has been working very diligently on their nutrient reduction strategy. They were one of the first states in the Mississippi River Basin to put a strategy in place that addresses both point sources, wastewater treatment plants, and non-point sources. So there's a tremendous amount of work going on in the state now to address excess nutrients in waters, which certainly has the ability to impact water quality. For example, the Des Moines water supply, which we hear about frequently in the news. So that effort is underway, and that's very important to the overall goal of improving and maintaining water quality in Iowa.
Okay, well, we are out of time. So very quickly, you have any coming up big priorities related to water quality or regulation in Iowa? What's next?
Well, what's really next is implementation of the nutrient strategy, and IDNR will be continuing to work on this work plan we talked about related to their CAFO permitting program. So those are two big priorities in Iowa right now as it relates to water.
Okay. Karen Flournoy, Water Division Director at Region 7 of the EPA. Karen Flournoy, thank you for talking with us today.
Okay, thank you very much.
This is a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio. Now, you might like the taste of beer, and you might not, but regardless, I'll say you might like the taste of this tidbit. Did you hear this news earlier this week? A bridge inspector was worried that he found a dangerous sinkhole near Interstate 380, but an investigation has determined that it most likely is a 150-year-old beer cave. Yes, beer cave. And if you aren't sure what that is, don't worry. You're not alone. Here with us to go, beer spelunking, I guess, is Brian Morelli, news reporter for The Gazette. And he joins us over the phone. Brian Morelli, thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Glad to have you on. So how was this uncovered?
So a bridge inspector, they're required to do, inspections on bridges every other year. And he was out doing this routine inspection, and he looks over in the shoulder of there's an access ramp to 380 in Cedar Rapids. It's 7th and 8th Street access ramp. And he looks over into the shoulder and notices a hole, about 18-inch hole in the ground. And, so his first thought is, it's just, what is down there? And he goes over and checks it out, and he realizes the hole keeps going down and down. And, his first inclination is, is there a safety concern here? And so they started to investigate, and they realized that it's probably these beer caves from this brewery that's been closed for nearly a century.
Okay, give it to us. What's a beer cave?
So back in the old day, before refrigeration, they would dig out these trenches in the ground, and either with brick or stone, you built these underground caverns to keep the beer cool and to help with the aging process. And this guy named Christian Magnus, who helped found this brewery up in Cedar Rapids, it was right on Cedar Lake. He came from Germany, and that was his philosophy on how to create this great tasting beer. And so they would build these caverns and then store the beer there to keep it cold and eventually get it out to the customers.
So what do we know about, so how long ago was this when this would have happened?
So the brewery was built in 1859, and when they built it, so they built the front of the brewery along the lake. It was about a five-story building, and then they built the back of the brewery up to this hillside, and they dug out the hill where they put the beer caves. So this was about 1860s, 70s. I think the height of production was in the 1890s, and the brewery kept going. It kind of changed names. Some of the more common names of the brewery were the Magnus Brewing Company and the Eagle Brewing Company. And I think the way someone explained it to me would be sort of how Anheuser-Busch is the brewery, but Budweiser is the beer that you would be familiar with. And so Eagle Beer was their popular brand of beer. And that was, they were brewing, I think, 25,000 barrels of beer in the late 1800s and early 1900s.
This is a big brewery then.
Yeah, it really is.
So what was found? Do we know what's found in this cave today? I mean, are there supplies in there? And these sorts of, maybe some very, very old beer?
Well, I wish. I asked to go down there, but they wouldn't let me. I don't know if they're holding out on me or what. After Prohibition, they stopped brewing beer. And a short time later, several years later, they finally closed down the brewery, tore it down, and it's sort of one of those things that would be forgotten about, and 20 years later, someone would be like, oh hey, there's beer caves down there, and that happened for decades, and I think the homeless people, I'm told, would use it, and they would have campfires down there and just hang out down there, and then it sort of became this rite of passage for kids. They would get dared to, they covered up the caves with boards and, warned people, do not enter. And so the kids would sneak in and check out the caves, which I guess go back for a ways. And then houses were built over the top of it. And then when they decided to run Interstate 80 through, they totally, tore down the houses and covered up the caves and ran the highway over it. So people are driving over this every day with, really not thinking about beer caves that are underneath. So they're covered up, and as far as getting down there, they say they still think it's too dangerous to get down there, so it doesn't sound like they're going to be doing any tours anytime soon.
Well, we're out of time, but there are many craft breweries opening up in Iowa, and that seems to be popular, so maybe we'll start seeing one of them brewing a Magnus Dark Ale, perhaps the Dark Ale. Thank you so much. Brian Morelli, news reporter for the Gazette, thank you for talking with us.
Thanks. Bye.
More to come on News Buzz. This is Rivered River from Iowa Public Radio News. Glad you're with us on Rivered River from Iowa Public Radio. It's a News Buzz edition of the program, and still ahead, we'll talk about why some Iowa counties are no longer honoring requests from U.S. immigration officials to hold certain inmates while their immigration status is checked. And the Iowa man who is the North American Ironman champion. That Iron Distance Triathlon consists of a 2.4-mile swim, 112-mile bike race, followed by a marathon, one after another. We'll get his thoughts as he'll be heading to the World Championship in Hawaii. But first, we remember historian and teacher Dorothy Schweder. Dorothy Schweder began teaching a class at Iowa State University about Iowa history, and just a few years, 500 students were signing up for it. known as the Dean of Iowa History. She brought a legitimacy to the study of state history, something that had previously been relegated to amateurs. And Schweder was a longtime member of the Iowa State History Department, began her teaching career there in 1966. She was the first woman to be tenured in the department and the only member of the department ever to be named university professor. Well, Dorothy Schweder died last week, and to remember her, we'll be talking with Tom Moraine, Iowa historian and director of governmental relations at Graceland University, longtime friend and colleague of Schweder's, and also co-author with her of Iowa Past to Present, The People and the Prairie. Tom Moraine, thanks so much for talking with us today.
Thank you.
I'm so sorry to hear about the loss of your friend and colleague, Dorothy Schweder.
That was a loss. She was both friend and colleague.
When did you first meet her?
When I started teaching Iowa history at Iowa State University, she was my job creator. As you said, the demand for Iowa history that she had created was such that she could no longer teach all the sections of the students who wanted to take it. So they hired me, and the rest is history.
Talk about what kind of a teacher she was.
Dorothy did a great job of grounding history in the lives of people. It wasn't abstract with her. Students could picture what was going on, the places, the situations that students or that her subjects were in. And she really made it come alive by her personal approach. She was good on the concepts, but the way she taught it, you could picture yourself being there. You could picture the people she was talking about.
Before we go farther, I wanted to listen back to an interview that was part of a show in September of 2011. You and Dorothy Schweder were a guest on Talk of Iowa with Charity Nebbe. And it was, I believe, the occasion was a reissue of the textbook that you worked on together. Let's hear a little clip of Dorothy's thoughts from that day.
And we really felt there needed to be a textbook that would not only cover Iowa's government and the development of industries and such, but also include the day-to-day life of Iowans. And there was ample material to use in this book. And so I think that this is really one of the main reasons that we decided to do this.
Again, Dorothy Schweder from an interview in September 2011 on Iowa Public Radio. And Tom Moraine, when you hear that, talk about that idea of looking back in history and her approach. Why do it that way?
Well, what she didn't say there was that the people Dorothy would interview and would talk to and would research were people who often did not make it into the history books. She talked about the wives of coal miners. She researched frontier women, frontier families, Iowa farm families. She and her husband Elmer did a book on Iowa's Old Order Amish, and a group that rarely wants to talk with outsiders. They welcomed Dorothy and Elmer into their house after the Schweders earned their trust. And she wrote lovingly about these people. They may have been gone for 150 years, but they still had dignity when Dorothy described them. It was a graciousness that she extended through her research and into her writing on the people she was describing.
Well, before you had met Dorothy Schweder, did you know many people that were doing history in that way?
No. She was on the front edge of what's called the new social history that really paralleled the civil rights movement of the time. The civil rights movement gave dignity to people that society had overlooked. Dorothy Schweder's history gave dignity to people that historians had overlooked.
Well, and it sounds like, from my understanding, that that style of hers really connected with people, with students in particular. And I wanted to play another audio clip from that interview of September 2011 on Talk of Iowa, Iowa Public Radio, where she talks a little bit about that student response.
One experience that I had that gives another dimension to this, some feedback from students. When I was teaching Iowa history, I had, and this was after the book had come out in 1989, I had a student in my class one day raised his hand at the beginning of the hour, and he said, I bring you greetings from my aunt, who had your Iowa history course 15 years before. Well, that produced something of a chuckle among the students. But then he said, and she wants you to know she's teaching fifth grade, and she is using the book, Iowa Past to Present. He then took out of his briefcase an envelope that was stuffed with responses from her students after they had started using this book. As one would expect, many of these were, I particularly like the story about pioneer life, or I thought this was interesting. But out of all of these, there were two that really rose to the top. One of these said, quote, how do you know all this stuff, unquote. And the second one said, are you sure that all of these things are really true, unquote. So occasionally we did get a little bit of feedback from the students.
Again, Dorothy Schweder, historian and teacher, speaking in September 2011 on Iowa Public Radio. Tom Moraine, Iowa historian, is talking with us. We know a little bit about what kind of a historian, what kind of a teacher Dorothy Schweder was, but what was she like as a person?
Dorothy was so genuine and so down-to-earth and Midwestern practical. I've got one favorite story. Dorothy and I both attended small liberal arts church-sponsored schools where liquor was a definite no-no at the time. And I remember the time when she passed her PhD comps that we wanted to celebrate in our office. We were sharing an office at the time. So we had a little water heater, and I brought in cocoa mix, and to make it special, I brought in a little vial of chocolate liqueur. Well, we had our cocoa with the chocolate liqueur, about half a vial of a small little vial of the liquid. And about 15 minutes later, she went down to the office to get her mail. And when she came back, she was laughing. She sat in her chair and just laughed. She said when she walked by a history colleague, her hand went up to cover her mouth so that he wouldn't smell the liquor on her breath. Now, this was about a capful of chocolate liqueur, but she said the old habits just kicked in, and she wanted to make sure he didn't smell the liquor on her breath as he passed. She didn't get away from her Midwestern roots. She never had airs about being more important than anybody else. She was just so genuine in everything she did, and we miss her.
Well, Tom Moraine, thank you so much for helping us remember Dorothy Schweder.
Thank you.
Continuing with our News Buzz edition of River to River on Iowa Public Radio, we turn now to immigration. Occasionally, the U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement asks a bit of a favor of county sheriffs, including those in Iowa. The federal agency asks that counties detain certain inmates for up to 48 hours so that their immigration status can be checked. A court ruling this spring in Oregon has been part of what encouraged some counties in Iowa, 22 of them out of 99, to stop honoring that request. One of the counties is Johnson County. Joining us now, Janet Linus is the Johnson County attorney. She joins us over the phone. So glad you're with us.
Thank you. Glad to be with you.
What exactly are these requests?
Basically, what we call ICE, the immigration authority you mentioned, issues what's called an I-247 detainer, and they issue it to a local sheriff or law enforcement agency who has in custody somebody that ICE is interested in looking at for possible deportation. If they believe that that person is here illegally, they make this request. What happens then is that the sheriff who is holding them or other law enforcement agency is holding that person would continue to hold that individual until 48 hours after they would normally be released for whatever's going on. So, for example, if we have somebody in Johnson County who was serving a 7-day sentence for an OWI second offense, at the conclusion of that 7-day sentence, ICE would have the opportunity to come and pick them up for 48 hours, and they previously would have been held for an additional 48 hours to give ICE authorities the opportunity to come and pick up that individual
So that person will be held at a county jail. And is the county compensated in some way for that?
The county might be compensated for holding them. The issue really has what's come up is not so much the compensation as the issue of whether it's legal to hold that person and whether that's a violation now of their constitutional rights. Just to explain a little bit about detainers, is Iowa sheriffs are regularly getting detainers from different state law enforcement agencies or potentially federal law enforcement agencies as well. When they want an individual in another jurisdiction who we currently have in our custody. So it may be that we picked up somebody again using the example of an OWI second, and it turns out that there is an arrest warrant for them out of California because they failed to appear on some other offense sometime in the past. And so California would have a detainer and say, please hold them and let us know when they're going to be released so we can bring them back to our jurisdiction to stand trial or whatever it is that they are looking at in California. So sheriff's offices get these requests to hold people all the time.
So sometimes Johnson County gets that request, and other times Johnson County might make that request of someone somewhere.
Exactly. So if we have somebody who failed to appear for a pretrial conference today and they show up in Illinois next week and they get picked up on something, we could make that request to detain them in Illinois until we could go get them or until we had an extradition hearing, basically.
So you were saying that the question was whether this might be a violation of a person's constitutional rights. I take it you believe it is a violation of the rights.
Right. I think that there is a possibility that the sheriff holding somebody for only for the ICE detainer could be a violation of their rights. The reason for that is normally the detainers are issued after there's been some kind of a court order from a judge. So that, you know, if, again, using the example in Johnson County, we would have somebody who failed to appear today. A judge would issue an order for their arrest. So a judge has been involved. So when they get picked up in Illinois on our request, there's already been some kind of judicial involvement with the judge saying that this person should have appeared here, and we have a basis for going to pick them up. With the ICE detainers, those are basically requests but have not gone through a formal process with the judge and made a determination that this person is in violation of immigration laws or things like that. And so all it is a request from ICE to detain that person, but without any kind of judicial involvement. Once they picked up that person, then they would have a right to get an attorney and things like that. But at the point where they're being held for those additional 48 hours, they don't have a right to an attorney. They don't have other due process rights. And so it's because of that that we've made the determination not to honor those detainers after the person would normally be released from Johnson County.
So what exactly was your specific recommendation? Just to have the people that are answering the phone say no thanks?
What would happen is once that ICE detainer is given to the Johnson or the Johnson County Sheriff receives that, is they would notify ICE that they have that person, but also could tell them when they are likely to be released from Johnson County. So if they have a particular sentencing date and they're being held till then, or they're serving a sentence and what day the sentence will expire, they could let ICE know, and then ICE could be here at the expiration of that time period and pick the person up, but we will not hold them beyond what we need to hold them for because of the Johnson County action.
Well, while you were determining whether or not you would make the recommendation that you made, there must have been some good reasons that you might have instead chosen to say, no, we can keep honoring these. It doesn't violate their rights. What were some of the reasons that were on that side of the decision?
Well, I think I think there's an argument that it's like we try to help other law enforcement agencies. And so if somebody is here in violation of the law, you know, whether it's because they've failed to appear in some other state or they're out looking for them in another state because of some other law violation, certainly Johnson County Sheriff would be trying to assist other law enforcement agencies. And you want to make sure that, you know, the law is being upheld wherever it is. I think our concern was that these I-247 detainers do not protect us from liability and do not have that judicial involvement. And so that's why we determined that we wouldn't be honoring those beyond the time that the person would normally be released.
Now, we've heard that 22 of the 99 counties have in Iowa have decided to stop honoring this request we're talking about. What do you know about the momentum that might be happening? Or do you hear from other county attorneys that they might be also making the same decision you've made?
I suspect that other county attorneys are looking at the issue. These detainers are not placed that frequently, so I suspect a lot of counties have not even had to look at the issue. There could be some changes. I suspect there may be changes in the law as well in terms of how these are handled and if there need to be some kind of judicial involvement before the detainers are issued, or having some kind of a hearing within the jurisdiction where the person is being held before the detainers are honored. So I think that there could be some legislative changes that address it as well.
Very good. Well, thank you so much for talking with us today.
Okay.
Janet Linus is the Johnson County attorney. Johnson County, along with a total of 22 of Iowa's 99 counties, have decided to stop honoring a request from the U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement that asks that they detain for up to 48 hours inmates to check their immigration status. And this is a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. Well, a man from Des Moines is the winner of the North American Ironman Championship. That's a triathlon where he swam 2.4 miles, rode a bike 112 miles, and then ran a marathon, all one after the other, last weekend to win that championship in Quebec. TJ Tollickson has won championship. He's also the CEO of Ruster Sports and Diamond Bikes. They make carbon fiber bicycles, which Tollickson used for the race. And TJ Tollickson joins us now. Thanks for being here.
Hi. Thanks for having me on the show.
Congratulations.
Thank you. I appreciate it. It was definitely the biggest win of my career so far. So it was a great race, and I'm very happy to win a North American championship.
So do I have this right to do all that, swimming 2.4 miles, biking 112 miles, then running a marathon, 8 hours and 16 minutes?
That's correct.
And how does that time compare to your typical time? Not your first Ironman triathlon, I imagine. How does it compare to other times?
The times are a little difficult to compare because they really are course dependent. So this is the first time I've raced on this course, and I did set a course record by about 10 minutes on this course, but it's far from the fastest course I've raced on. So my fastest time is actually 8:07, and that's a race in an Ironman race in Phoenix, Arizona. But this is certainly one of my faster times. Like I said, I did set a course record by almost 10 minutes on this one. So it was a very good day for me.
You set a course record, and looks like the person that came in second was nearly 20 minutes behind you.
Yeah, that's right. It was actually a little bit of a battle of survival out there for most of the other competitors that, I started the run. I had about an 8-minute lead, and they actually were doing a poll on Ironman.com during the race, asking people watching the live coverage if they thought the second place guy was going to catch me, because Andy Raylard has 4 times been on the podium at the Ironman World Championships in Hawaii. So he's one of the best runners in the sport. And 80% of the people watching the race coverage thought that I was going to get caught during the marathon portion of the run. So I definitely had that in my head as well, even though I didn't know that poll was going on during the race. So, I really kept the pace on as fast as I could for most of the marathon. And then, was able to relax a little bit towards the end when I saw I had about 5 miles to go and I had over a 2-mile lead on my closest competitor. So it was pretty nice to be able to take some of the pressure off me, relax those last 5 miles, and still get in and win by a large margin.
You say you relaxed those last 5 miles.
Did
I hear you right? Okay.
Yeah, as much as relaxing you can do at the end of an Ironman. But the hard part is those are usually your toughest miles anyway. And so being able to back off on the pace a little bit and focus more on my nutrition. I told myself with 5 miles to go that I won the race, but make sure now you don't lose the race. There are some pretty epic moments captured on film at Ironman competitions where people have had huge margins of leads going into the final miles and have collapsed and not been able to actually make it to the finish line. And so I told myself, don't don't make this one of the most epic fails of an Ironman. Just relax a little bit and make it in for the win.
So you won the North American Ironman Championship. You'll be going to the World Championship?
Yeah, so the World Championships will be in Kona, Hawaii on October 11th. They're always on the big island of Hawaii in mid-October. So I've got a couple months to rest up and get ready to do that race.
Yeah, well, you mentioned earlier that each course might be kind of different, but I imagine especially going from Quebec water to Hawaii water might be a bit of a different situation.
Yeah, you know, we swam in a lake in Quebec, and the race is actually at a ski resort in Mont Tremblant, Quebec. So the water was pretty cold, and we wore wetsuits. And, of course, the race in Hawaii will swim in the ocean, and so there definitely won't be any wetsuits in that race. So well, water's, you know, beautiful at both places, equally as clear and stunning. But, yeah, it'll be quite a bit warmer in Hawaii.
Good luck to you.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
TJ Tollickson is a professional triathlete from Des Moines, winner of the North American Ironman Championship. This has been River to River from Iowa Public Radio News.